You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
And a special guest rogue, George Robb. George, welcome back, man.
500.
Hello. 500. George, that's right.
Hi, guys.
Hey, George.
I haven't seen you since New Zealand, I think.
Some airport.
Yes, the airport in Newark before that was New Zealand, yes.
Hey, George, did you hear what happened to Steve the night that we all got home from the trip?
I mean, I heard something about, you know, drunk driving and a house jumping out in front of him and ice and some kind of a freeze thing. And yeah, I didn't read the news reports, but no, what was the deal? You smashed into your house because you were so happy to be home?
I crashed into my own house after a day of travel halfway around the world.
No,
you missed it so
until
much.
The last 1 foot.
literally the last inch of my journey. I was, it was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
The roads were a little icy, so I was taking it very slow. I mean, literally thinking to myself, I am not going to crash 2 miles from my house after traveling for a day.
And you did.
Halfway around the world. So I got to the top of my driveway. There's a slight, you know, angle down to my driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And
a little
I
bit more
opened the garage door. Mm-hmm. I eased onto my driveway. And I've done this a lot. You know, I know how to drive down my own driveway. But as soon as I got onto my driveway, I was in total free fall. It was glass. It was just smooth ice. There was no snow or anything.
Yeah.
It was like practically frictionless. I had zero control. I just slid all the way down my driveway and into my house.
Wow.
That's it.
Well, they say most accidents happen within a mile of your house, you know, so
yeah,
this is true.
2 inches of your house.
I always say move. That's what I might recommend. But, now was anybody home?
My family was home.
They were all home, right? Cause they had gone home earlier. So they were home. What did they think was happening as you smashed into the house?
I woke up my wife.
Right. Steve's home. This Steve's home.
Yeah. But she didn't really have time to process what was happening
before
I got upstairs and told her what happened. She's like, oh, that's what that loud bang was. Okay.
Because they were still jet-lagged too, I guess, right? Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
How was the car, Steve?
It's in the shop.
How's the house?
It's got a broken doohickey. You know, the thing between the two garage doors is broken.
Doohickey.
The lintel.
You know, Steve, so under those circumstances, what do you do? Do you yell out, or do you have like some type of ivory tower type? Oh, no,
I've had a collision with a immobile
object. Oh, drat.
Coefficient of friction. Not ideal.
Cor blimey.
I was too tired to even do anything, I think.
You're just glad you were home.
Yeah, so 500, huh?
Here we are.
Wow,
this
guys.
Is it. This is our literal 500th episode.
My
we're halfway
gosh.
To 1,000.
What year will that be, is 1,000? That'll be what, 2025? No.
Yeah.
About
2025.
We'll be long dead.
Roughly.
Predictions. Come on. Predictions. Let's go. 1,000 episode predictions so we can play this back at 1,000. Which one of us is in prison?
Oh, boy.
Debtor's prison? Or?
It's got to be Jay.
It's got to be Jay, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think what'll happen is once I hit 50, I'll get really pissed off and I'll just start random fist fights in public.
You're going to grow up to be the old angry man that, you know, walking around shaking their fist at the world.
No, to answer your question though, like it would be interesting. Let's right now make a 10-year prediction.
Nuclear fusion.
Not 10 years.
No, it's always 2 to 5 years away. So I'm doubling. I'm doubling the thing. No, not fusion. What's the big thing?
Got, Bob?
Yeah. What's the big thing?
Virtual reality glasses are ubiquitous.
I'll buy that.
Didn't Google retract their glass recently?
Retract it? You mean like take, you know?
They pulled it off the market, didn't they?
It never really got to the open market like that. It was just the Explorers Club. I thought they were retooling it. That's what I assume that's what they were doing.
Martian base or Martian people on Mars?
Ooh, okay.
Maybe? No?
I don't,
yeah.
Still, it's too.
Not enough time?
A lot of time, a lot of money too.
Yeah.
Lots of cosmic rays.
Right. Right. Electric cars?
Self-driving electric.
Self-driving. Google, 80% of the cars on the road now are electric, right? And half are self-driving. No, 30% are half driving.
Yeah, I'd say about 30%. What do you guys think about cyborgs? Like people, like mass implants of RFID chips?
Well, I don't know about mass implants, but, you know, there will be a little bit of, you know, a little biofusion there with the chips and the computers and stuff.
I don't think it's going to take off within 10 years. That's one of those, it's hard to predict. People might reject it. You know what I mean? It's not a matter of technology. It's a matter of culture.
Oh, I got it. I got it, guys. 10 years from now, people will start vaccinating again.
Oh, I don't know. Will I have a full head of hair? That's a question.
Oh, my God, George, you know what? That is actually possible.
Sure. They make wonderful wigs nowadays.
Stop it.
No.
Five minutes.
Seriously.
Stem cells, right, Jay?
Yeah.
I think in 10 years, a lot of homes will have most of the appliances, even down to the lights on the internet.
Internet of things,
Your home will be on the internet.
Oh, smart home.
Smart your home?
I think solar power will be much, much more common.
Yes. Oh, boy.
Because we're just getting at that point now where it's, for a lot of locations, it's actually financially feasible. It's economical to have solar power. We're crossing that line 10 years from now. For a while, I've been sort of waiting for the breakthrough, like the solar breakthrough. But now I realize there isn't going to be a breakthrough. We're just going to have continuous incremental improvements. And, you know, it's going to be a little bit better every year.
Yeah, like cancer treatment.
All these things we're reading about, yeah, enough of them are coming to fruition that we'll get these incremental improvements. And in 10 years, they're going to be way over that line where there'll be no reason not to have – if you have a roof, there's no reason not to have solar on it, you know?
But no solar highways.
No solar highways.
Probably not. Not in this country.
Now, what didn't exist when you guys started the show?
Were iPhones around in 2005?
iPhones? YouTube? YouTube wasn't around yet, was it?
I don't think so.
Right around that time, Facebook was
just launched, just around, right?
Yeah, like 2005.
The Facebook, yeah. Right. Used on campuses.
No Avengers movies?
Oh, gosh.
But smartphones were not as common. We were still using the clamshells.
Right.
Yeah, the Kirk.
How about iPods? And iPads, rather. iPad.
iPods,
yes, they came out first.
I remember the first few years, every Christmas, we had a measurable bump in our listeners just because people got iPods for Christmas.
Nice.
Right.
And the podcasting world took a leap, and we took a leap with it.
Well, when we started, the podcasts themselves were completely in their infancy. Nobody knew about it.
Not on iTunes.
Not on iTunes. Not many people were listening. There weren't that many podcasts. Now it just exploded.
There was no Geologic podcast when we started.
Nope.
So, George, you're coming up on 400, right?
I'm coming up on 400, yes.
400!
Wow, that's awesome, George.
I am out of ideas. It's official. I have nothing left to talk about.
You have rung your brain. Yes. It's like ringing the sponge.
I'm going to just start sort of bisecting my body with a knife. Just that's all that's left to do, I think. Just you know, make slices of me and just have that for each show.
Don't be ridiculous. First of all, you could have an all Mortimer episode.
That's called a spinoff.
Okay. Maybe that'll be the 400th episode. He'll just take over.
Facts that'll fuck you up is like the best bit. Like that, you know, your most recent ones you came up with is one of the best.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. And if you can think of any, let me know. No. I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. No, it's been, I think much like you guys, I had no intention of doing this for, you know, 8 years. It was just like, let's do this for a while, see what happens. I'm sure you guys weren't thinking, oh, let's see if we can get 10 years out. So it's pretty cool.
In retrospect, at that point in 2005, we had been a skeptical society for what was coming up on 10 years. And, you know, trying to do a little bit of future prediction at the time, like where can we go? What's different and what's going to be new and exciting? And where can we take this, our ideas of skepticism and, you know, bring it to new audiences and so forth? So
yeah,
I
wasn't thinking about a specific time frame, but it was like, all right, this is what we're doing now, and this will go indefinitely as long as it's working.
Right.
You know?
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to record an excellent 500th episode. And then the next week's show, which will be episode 501, we'll record during our 500th episode celebration house party, which we're doing this weekend. Woo-hoo, we're going to have a lot of guests for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. But let's get started here. Bob, you're going to do a Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
This week, I'm going to cover Charles Richard Drew, who was a surgeon, researcher, and teacher, but he was also a trailblazing African-American who pioneered the processing and preservation of blood plasma and is known as the father of the blood bank. Ever hear of him?
Yeah, because of MASH. They talked about
yeah,
him on
the
MASH
episode. That's mm-hmm. right.
No way. Of course. That makes perfect sense. Excellent.
And they got it wrong, but go ahead.
Their heart was in the right place.
Yes, it was. Charles was born June 3rd, 1904 in D.C., Washington, D.C. He was a gifted athlete with medals and scholarships, but his primary love was science, biology, and as it turns out, blood. During his education and research at McGill University and then Columbia University, he spent a lot of time working with others on blood and blood transfusion, and we take it for granted now, but at that time, it was only very recently discovered that blood actually came in types, A, B, O, etc. So the biggest problem then wasn't actually, you know, mixing incompatible types. That didn't happen that much anymore, but making it last. Because the whole blood, after all, spoils only after 7 days. So how do you make it last? How do you get it to people who really need it? So Drew's main focus comes in here, and that was called banking blood. His doctoral research synthesized all the cutting-edge knowledge across multiple disciplines to learn what worked and what didn't, what the Russians were doing, what they were doing, what they tried. He was all over trying to find out what everyone knew. And then he basically designed the entire process that a blood bank would have to do, acquiring the blood, finding and testing and getting the people together, testing the blood, and then banking it for like a large-scale effort. So he and his colleagues, and he didn't do this alone, he had lots of colleagues, they set up a test blood bank that ran for months and was a big success. And that's where it all really started for him. So then after that, his plan was scaled up. And he was selected as a medical supervisor for the campaign called Blood for Britain during World War II to send blood and blood plasma to British soldiers who were in need. And this eventually led to a Red Cross pilot program. And this is where he came up with the idea for the refrigerated blood mobiles. And he did a lot of work on dehydrated plasma, which was incredibly useful. I mean, plasma is basically blood without the cells in it. So it's just the proteins and things that are outside of the cell walls that are still very useful for treating shock and doing lots of other things, getting blood volume inside of you. So this entire thing was essentially the template for the National Blood Donor Service. Everything that came afterwards had a huge basis on what he was doing here. And this is why people call him the father of blood banks. And unfortunately, towards this end of his career, it kind of left him with a bit of a sour note. Drew became very, very upset when an order came down from the Army and the Navy that blood donations from African Americans would be refused, just flat out refused. No, we are not taking your blood. He argued that it was unscientific because there was not one shred of evidence, essentially, that race mattered at all when it came to blood and for blood plasma. So eventually other scientists confirmed his position, and the blood donations were then accepted from African Americans, but they were still segregated. So that really did leave a sour taste in his mouth. And I'll end it with a quote from him regarding this, which he mentioned in the latter part of his life. He said, "It is fundamentally wrong for any great nation to willfully discriminate against such a large group of its people. One can say quite truthfully that on the battlefields, nobody is very interested in where the plasma comes from when they are hurt. It is unfortunate that such a worthwhile and scientific bit of work should have been hampered by such stupidity."
It's awesome. It's really awesome to hear, you know, someone as intelligent as he was that came up with something so wonderful, and also for him to be so socially progressive. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we're looking back 70 years later, and of course he was exactly right. And by our current standards, that was just ridiculously racist to segregate blood.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Yeah.
So read up on Charles Richard Drew. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing extracellular matrices containing globulins and fibrinogens. And most people should know what he accomplished.
So since we brought up MASH, you know, what they perpetuated a myth. So what is true is that Drew was killed in a car accident in 1950. He's only 45 years old. He was driving.
He fell asleep.
I was home after a late night in the surgical theater. and crashed, was pinned, had severe injuries, and he died shortly after arriving at the hospital from his injuries. The myth was that he died because he was refused a transfusion because of his color. But that's not true.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Yeah, that's what was repeated on MASH. That myth. Yeah. Myth. But yeah, it had no impact. It was true at the time that would happen, that people, there were hospitals that would only treat white people, and there were hospitals that would segregate whites and blacks and wouldn't accept a black if they didn't have any black beds. And so.
Black beds?
Yeah, they segregated the patients. Yeah. So.
And the sheets.
But that did not happen to him. That's the myth. He died because his wounds were fatal. Nothing at the time would have saved him.
Steve, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I was wondering, you know, there's the position now in terms of the Red Cross and blood donation doesn't take blood from homosexual men. And just, it's interesting sort of the parallels here of a viable supply that's not being used because of the whole sort of, you know, AIDS concerns and things like that. And that's, I think it's, they're trying to change that rule. I'm just wondering what your take is on that. Cause I know that when you do donate blood, one of the main questions asked is, you know, have you ever had any homosexual experiences? And if you say yes, you can't donate. And I remember being surprised by that while donating blood and thinking, wow, that's like a huge pool that isn't being taken advantage of.
Restricting a high risk population, you know, may not be the best approach. You know, the reason for it is not discriminatory. The reason for it is an identified high risk population.
Oh, sure. You know? I just thought, you know, since they do treat most of the blood anyway, and it is all tested as well, boy, it just seems like it's a huge, you know.
Yeah. So the American Red Cross also put out a statement. This is 2014. It's about 7 months ago, saying that the current lifetime deferral for men who have had sex with other men should be modified. And that donor deferral criteria should be made comparable with criteria for other behaviors that pose an increased risk of transmission of transfusion-transmitted infections. Yeah, they're calling to modify the rules.
All right, so they're working on it. Well, that's good. So,
yeah. All right, let's go on to some news items. We're going to start with a recent survey comparing the opinions of scientists, specifically members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS, with the public at large on various scientific issues. And as you might suspect, there were some differences.
Survey said.
Yeah. So here are a few of the more interesting ones. Favoring use of animals in research. 89% of the scientists agreed with that. 47% of the public did. Safe to eat foods grown with pesticides. 68% of scientists were okay with that. Only 28% of the public were. Humans have evolved over time. 98% of scientists agree with that. Only 68% of the public do. Childhood vaccine should be required. 86% scientists, 68% public. Climate change is mostly due to human activity. 87% scientists, 50% public. Favor building more nuclear power plants. That's an interesting one. 65% scientists, 45% public. But the biggest gap was on what question.
The single biggest gap?
I was going to say vaccines, but I guess that's not it.
Yeah, it's not vaccines.
GMOs?
So. GMOs. There you go. 88% of scientists said there's no health concerns about the safety of GMO food, but only 37% of the public did. That's a 51% gap in opinion. That was the biggest gap of any topic. Isn't that interesting? Wow. So, I mean, obviously one of the premises here is that scientists are more likely to have a science-based opinion than the public, which, you know, I happen to agree with the scientists on all of these questions. I think for a lot of these, there's a pretty strong scientific consensus. For other things like favor building more nuclear power plants, that's one of those issues that's informed by science, but there may be other issues in there that it's not a strictly scientific question. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas, and same thing with like childhood vaccine should be required. You know, that there's a lot of nuance there. That you could see that even a scientist who understands the evidence that vaccines are safe and effective, et cetera, understands herd immunity, they might have reservations about, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that we don't allow religious exemptions? And you could see some scientists backing off due to that. But like climate change is mostly due to human activity. That's not a policy recommendation. That's just a pure scientific statement. That's just what does the evidence show? But even there, I was surprised. Only 87% of those surveyed. So I wonder what – these surveys always obviously are highly variable depending on exactly how you ask the question. Mm-hmm. So it's always tricky. But
is it encouraging that most of the non-scientist responses were above 50%?
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that as well, vaccines.
Yeah. It's almost encouraging in a weird way. Like, okay. I mean, apart from the GMO one, which is whatever, 37. But okay.
And like, pesticides are 28.
Okay. Well, there you go. Those two. Yeah. See, again, food related sort of.
Yeah.
It's curious.
Assuming that the gap is a bad thing, you know, how do we close it? There's no easy answer to that. I mean, obviously more education, but we know from dealing with these issues for a long time that people don't reject climate change, you know, anthropogenic global warming, because they've evaluated the science and they have a different interpretation of the scientific data. You know, most non-scientists, non-experts have absolutely no idea what the evidentiary basis of climate change is, you know?
Yeah, it's a gut feeling.
And there was a recent survey where they basically showed that people who reject climate change do so because they reject the proposed solutions.
Yes.
Right. They're against the government taking over corporations, you know, as a solution to climate change. Therefore, I'm going to disagree with the science.
Right. Or I have to give up my car because I like my car and other possessions that create carbon emissions. I have to stop doing these things. They don't want to give that up.
But so I always find that frustrating. But this is very, very common that people have a political or social or ideological opinion. And then it's like they have to twist the science to fit their ideology. It's like you're against animal research. So they say, well, animal research doesn't work anyway. That's not true. You know, it's okay to be against animal research as a moral issue, but acknowledge, okay, I know it has its utility in certain kinds of research, but I'm still against it. But why do people are so uncomfortable with that? Why can't they say, I don't like, you know, carbon credits, even though I know, you know, the earth is warming due to carbon emissions?
I think people want to convince themselves or appear like they have an educated opinion, so that they can defend that opinion, not just, oh, because it just feels this way, but they can say, oh, well, it doesn't, you know, animal testing doesn't work. So that way they have an informed opinion, even though their opinion isn't informed, but they can present it as if it's an informed opinion to themselves more than anybody else. I think that's a big part of it. We do that. I mean, everybody does that on some level where it's like, you know, I don't like the taste of this kind of food because whatever. And it's not just because of your taste, but you'll have some reason why you don't like it, or don't like a particular movie, or don't like something, or, you know, something innocuous like that. You'll make up a reason so that you can have a quote unquote informed opinion. Whereas often it just comes down to, oh, well, I just don't like it or whatever. I bet that's.
Yeah, George, you hate yellow mustard, right?
I do.
It's poison. That's why.
I have a good reason, though. The Illuminati have been making mustard for generations. You know?
Yeah, but it's just, I don't know. It's you can separate your moral opinions from factual state of science. You know what I mean? It's a failed strategy. If you're saying, I'm against animal research because it doesn't work. Well, when you're proven wrong by the evidence, then your moral position collapses along with it. So it's not a good strategy.
But it's also like, that means that you like to torture animals. You know, because the one side has such a impactful argument in terms of showing pictures of bunnies' eyes being torn out, you know, that's the one side, whereas the other side is some successful product. The more shocking image is going to have a much larger impact on someone. So when you're going to ask them, are you okay with animal testing? In their mind, it's going to be like, are you okay with torturing animals? That's the question.
Oh my God.
Because the one side is presented it that way, that, oh, animal testing is torturing animals, you know, or whatever the subject may be. But I think it's a marketing and a presentation of the argument. And the one side is presented a much more daunting argument that you have to defend against.
And Steve, you mentioned that, you know, when the evidence proves them wrong, you know, their moral position collapses as well. But the premise though is that they accept the fact that they are proven wrong. And we know all the logical fallacies and mental gymnastics that people go through to just not accept what science is telling them.
And no, they won't accept that they've been proven wrong, but so it motivates them to engage in motivated reasoning and pseudoscience, yes, and bad logic and all of that. But other people will reject them because their factual position is wrong. You know, it puts them in an untenable position where you're in a much stronger position if you accept the scientific facts as they are. So the other angle to this whole issue is kind of a manifestation of the Dunning-Kruger effect. Why is it that so many people have an opinion that differs from the scientific community? Do they not know what the scientific community believes, or do they reject it? And if they reject it, they're essentially saying that they know better than the experts. And that is such an arrogant position. You know what I mean? Which, of course, usually they're the ones accusing others of being arrogant. So what I like to do is ask people to consider an area of their expertise. I remember, George, we were in Australia. You were telling us about weddings, right? You were saying that, you've done hundreds of weddings.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have some sense of what works and what doesn't work in a wedding.
Right.
So how do you feel when people substitute their opinions based upon having participated in no weddings with your extensive experience?
Yeah, of course. It's not just having not participated in weddings, but they've seen what has been presented as maybe successful weddings, you know, in movies, or they've had experiences on the outskirts of what a successful wedding is, and they sort of reinterpret it. So yeah, we'll literally say, look, we've done 400 weddings and you've done none. Like, trust us. This is what will work at your reception. This is what we want to do. If you want, you know, we will do whatever the client wants eventually. But, you know, we make the argument. So yeah, of course, it's, you just sort of, any respect for their opinion or their insistence, you know, just sort of goes out the window, because it doesn't matter how insistent someone is. If you're going up against expertise, it doesn't really matter how much. If you're adamant, it doesn't really matter, because you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's not even like a complicated scientific question.
Yeah, right, you know? Right.
It's kind of a practical one. But think about anything that you're an expert on. What does the general public know about it?
Sure.
Do you think the general public has a pretty good handle on your area of expertise? Yeah. I've yet to meet anybody who would say yes to that question.
Well, everyone, Steve, you're a doctor. I mean, you deal with this all the time. Yeah. You're telling people amazingly difficult things that they have to deal with. What do you do? How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I treat patients who are the entire spectrum, you know, from fellow physicians to people have absolutely no idea, you know, about even the basics. But, and there's a informed consent issue, you know, where I'm sort of obligated to explain to them as best as I can and make sure that they understand the decision that they're making, but then they ultimately make the decision. So it's kind of a special area. Right. There's a practical decision to be made, but like people accepting or rejecting evolution or climate change, they're not forced to make any kind of practical decision for their life on those issues. It's just, what do you think about the science? What does it say? And they're happy to reject the opinion of experts for their own sense. But meanwhile, like if they're a mechanic, you know, what do you think about your average customer and their knowledge about how to be a good mechanic? Well, they would know from experience that it's terrible. You know, that if you're not an expert in something, your knowledge about it is probably pretty wanting, because you're just absorbing what you can from the culture, which, and TV and media, you know, which is incredibly inaccurate about any area that's even remotely sophisticated. So there is, this is like the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you don't even know enough to know how little you know or how much of a gap there is between your knowledge and the expert knowledge. So, and I get that a lot when I talk to people, like, for example, who reject evolution. They have no idea. They have no idea how much information evolutionary biologists have that they don't have. You know, the knowledge of whatever, everything, the genetics, the fossil evidence, all the different lines of evidence and how detailed and technical it is. And they're sort of shooting from the hip based upon very superficial misinformation about the area and think that they actually know better. Like, oh, those scientists are stupid. They don't know what they're talking about. Really? Really? How many technical journals have you read and understood? You know, if you could really get them to understand that, the only, I think, reasonable conclusion is that you need to be humble, which you know, I know we've said before that skepticism and critical thinking is largely an exercise in humility. You know, people have an overconfidence bias. You have to fight against that. You have to fight against your own personal Dunning-Kruger effect. You have to assume you lack information. You should assume that experts know things you don't know and have a baseline sort of respect for a consensus, you know, a robust consensus of relevant experts. And if you think there's something wrong with the consensus and you have a lot of work to do, you shouldn't reject it casually and assume that you know better than they do, because chances are you're going to be wrong.
That has to go hand in hand with an appreciation of expertise, though, too, because to say – it's important to be able to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you get, for example, in climate change, politicians that love to say, well, I'm not a scientist, which is then followed by, but this is what I think about the da-da-da. So I think I think it's important to be able to say, I don't know. But you know what? You know who does know? This scientist who's an expert in this thing, and I'm going to defer to them. I think that's a difficult thing to sort of train or to teach, but it's like super important to say it's okay not to know, but it's just as okay or even more important than to defer to people that actually do. And how you, and what's nice is you have the ability to determine if someone is an expert like that. You know, that shouldn't be this mysterious thing. Is someone an expert on a certain subject or a certain topic?
Yeah. Although that is getting trickier because there are a lot of fake experts.
Yeah, that's true too. But
But that's why you have to go a little bit beyond that to say, okay, you know, there's a consensus of experts that I'm reading about in recognized academic, you know, outlets, you know, things that are, this is not some narrow ideological group. This is a generic scientific organization that, you know, generally should be trusted, like the AAAS. The AAAS doesn't have any ideological axe to grind. It's just a scientific organization. You know, it's a prestigious scientific organization. So, you know, if they come to a conclusion on something, you should at least take it seriously, and it should at least give you pause, you know? And you shouldn't just dismiss it out of hand. Mm-hmm. But again, that's why I used, like, your own area of expertise. What are you? It doesn't matter what it is. You're an expert on fishing lures. It doesn't matter. Whatever you're an expert on, just think about the gap between your knowledge and the average person in the street. Well, as ignorant as you think they are, that's how ignorant you are about everything else in the world.
Right. So, yeah, dope. Think of any time something is shown in a film or on TV that
you happen to know about.
And you happen to know about it. You will, every single person, whether it's a mechanic or some, making fishing lures or a makeup artist or an astronaut, they will go, oh, jeez, really? That's really? No, that's not how it works. Every time. Very rarely does a film come out where it's like, wow, that was really spot on. That was really well done. You know, those are the exceptions. So yeah, so that's a great way to think of it. Like whenever you see your expertise done in popular culture, it's usually done wrong. And why? Because you know a lot about it. Well, you know that little about everything else on the planet.
Everything else.
Yeah, that's great. Right.
So that's one thing you talked about. Like, what did we learn in the last 10 years? What were the experience? I've become much more humble, I think, in the last 10 years.
This is you being humble?
For, really? I mean, I say I don't know about a lot of things. Like, even like, I used to get into discussions and feel free to like have an opinion about lots of things I had no business having an opinion on. Now it's more like, if we're talking about something, even in politics or whatever, it's like, I'll much more quickly get to the conclusion. You know what? Neither of us have any idea what's going on.
Right.
Here.
Right.
The real information, we are so far from it. What we're getting fed in the media is probably so far from what's really going on. I think that we just have to agree that neither of us know what the real answer is here, and just, rather than substituting our ideological answer.
Yeah. So George, that's Steve's version of humble. I don't know shit, but you don't know shit either.
Yeah, that's right.
that's the U2 fallacy.
Over the past, sure, I could say 20 years, but the podcast is really when things started to take off with our education and our real respect and understanding of skepticism and everything. And it took quite a while to get to the point where it's not painful at all to say, I don't know, or to be wrong. Those two things are actual skills because they take time. You can't just say, I'm going to not care about these two things, or I'm not going to care that I'm wrong, and I'm not going to have a problem apologizing. They are hard, and you have to learn how to do it.
I love hearing from the experts.
It's true. But that's also best. Part of the humbling is whatever we talk about, there's somebody who's a world expert on it, did their thesis on it or whatever. Yep. And they will show us the gap between us making a sincere effort to understand something and what the experts really understand. We get slapped in the face with that every week just about. And it's a great experience. That humbling experience is awesome.
Well, Steve, watching you give your talks about memory in the last, 5 years since I've known you guys, I've seen you do a number of sort of different talks about memory. And that's something that's completely changed in me, where I will never, ever again say, I swear this is what happened.
Yeah.
I will always say, to my best memory, this is what happened, or this is what
the narrative my brain is constructed for.
But
these are the series of pictures.
But I could be wrong. I am completely remembering it this way, but I acknowledge that that could be completely false and probably is completely false. Like, I never would have said that 10 years ago. It would have been, this is how I'm remembering it, and you're wrong. So we need to make those changes in ourselves over time. So it's nice to be able to do that.
Yep. All right, Evan, you're going to tell us about the latest in ghost detecting gadgetry.
Yeah, the writers over at Engadget.com wrote a little article recently about a forthcoming device called the Ghost Arc. Well, according to the Ghost Arc website, it is the world's first all-in-one ghost hunting equipment. So what the Swiss Army knife did for Boy Scouts, the Ghost Arc will do for ghost hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean lots of thumb injuries? Is that what that means?
Oh, gosh. This is a ghost detector that fits in your pocket, and it's purported to have everything you need to track down supernatural beings, including an electromagnetic field meter, a pair of high-sensitivity microphones, radio frequency sweeping sensors, a temperature gauge, and an atmospheric pressure sensor. Oh, and as an added bonus, if you act right now, you can have a white noise bolster, which will strengthen all your signals and will effectively complete the illusion of doing something productive.
Right.
Yes. And what
they should call it the specter detector.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll trademark
maybe
that.
We'll make a competing device, the specter detector. It'll blow them away.
Oh, God.
Remember, it just has one setting. It just says nope.
Perry's Nopometer. Oh, he came up with that 20 years
the
ago.
The Nopometer, yeah.
The Nopometer. It's actually much more accurate than any of these.
It's 100% accurate.
All the time.
Guaranteed.
Accurately detects the presence of ghosts.
Oh, you have to make one of those, guys. Oh, my gosh. You have to make one of those.
Yes, we do. How are we going to do it?
Seriously, that's like that. People would oh, my gosh, that's the best thing ever. The SGU endorsed. Spectre detector/Nopometer.
Yeah.
100% like effective.
our own dynamizer. Yeah.
Designed by Perry DeAngelis.
Concept by Perry DeAngelis. Yeah. Designed by SGU.
Guaranteed to work or triple your money back.
Right. That's right.
If it ever fails to detect a ghost, we will absolutely give you triple your money back.
Speaking of money, do you know how much the Ghost Arc is going to cost you? It's $250. But.
What?
But if you pre-order, which means they're not ready to ship these things yet.
It's only $249.99.
$200 if you give them money ahead of time before they have any of these products to dispense. These things, these ghost detection devices, it's part of what we call the trappings of science. So when a paranormalist or pseudoscientist utilize scientific tools for unscientific purposes, it's merely a thin attempt to validate their methods by being able to say, look, we're using real tools and we're being scientific.
Yeah. And playing at being scientists. Yeah.
That's right. And it's the equivalent of me having a calculator, punching away at it and saying, look, I'm using a calculator. I'm a mathematician now.
Yeah. It's the equivalent of a 3-year-old punching away at a calculator and thinking they're a mathematician. You actually might understand the numbers that you're looking at, so that's not a fair analogy.
Okay. Oh, I've given him too much credit.
It's still an awesome analogy. I love it.
Evan, I'm going to challenge you. I challenge you to call this company up and tell them that we're a popular podcast and we want to review their product. Send us a free sample.
They just have a beta. They don't even have
– Yeah.
They don't have something to send us.
Yeah, they're only in beta. A lot of nice pictures of the thing, though. It's kind of sharp looking and has some knobs and things. But
yeah, that's just
It's rendered. That's not even –
It's rendered. Yeah, it's not a real device.
Plus, you gotta love Engadget. Their first sentence for this article is, let's get this out of the way. Ghost detection is based on junk science. First sentence. Love it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Set the record straight. So there's no way of interpreting that any other way that they are not endorsing this thing as science.
Yeah, they're just right. They're doing it for fun. It's actually, they know their audience will think it's funny.
So let's talk a little bit, just for a few seconds, about the actual technology here. So there's an EM detector, right? You got to have an EM detector. Why do ghosts give off electromagnetic waves? Because they could be measured by people holding gadgets. What frequency do they give off? Whatever the gadgets measure. Mm-hmm. There's no particular reason to suspect that ghosts would give off any particular frequency. And isn't it a nice coincidence that they give off the frequency measured by handheld EM meters?
Why are you looking for your keys underneath the street lamp? Because that's the only place I'm going to find it.
That's right? Where the light's good.
Yeah. So, right. So these could be dragon detectors and leprechaun detectors.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. they could be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Bigfoot detectors.
Bigfoot detectors.
Whatever you want.
In reading up a little more about this, I read a piece by Ben Radford, and he wrote, and he summed it up pretty nicely. For any piece of equipment to be useful, it has to have proven connection to ghosts, as far as ghost detectors goes. The problem is that there is no body of research showing that anything these devices measure has anything to do with ghosts. And until we can reliably demonstrate that ghosts have measurable characteristics, these devices are irrelevant. And that is exactly right.
The thing is, in the real world, when you have a device that measures something, you have to test it against a gold standard, right? You have some known standard. The problem is, we don't have a known standard here because there's no such thing as ghosts, right? There's nothing you could say, this is a certifiable 100%. We know this is a ghost phenomenon. So now we could see what happens to an EM meter in the presence of a ghost. And then we could use that as a standard to detect other things that may or may not be ghosts. In this case, we have no standard. They're just making it up. Now, for a new phenomenon, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of science to establish the characteristics of a new phenomenon. But they haven't done that. They haven't done even the basic groundwork to begin to say that ghosts exist as a phenomenon and that these measures have any relationship to this phenomenon. All they're doing is just very superficial anomaly hunting. Oh, temperatures are going up and down. There's electromagnetic waves here. And they declare any anomaly that they encounter a ghost, but they have not closed the loop on the science, not even close.
What astounds me is that if you have people that are willing to buy this, and they would get it because they think it's going to detect ghosts. If you had the same device that had a Loch Ness monster setting on it, they would think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, well,
you're right.
I'm not gonna find a Loch Ness monster in my apartment. That's just stupid. That's crazy. Like, where is that point where it goes from ghosts are possible because, again, they're sort of not understandable to, oh, well, if it's got a Loch Ness monster setting, that's just crazy. Who's gonna believe that? It's so interesting.
Yeah, that's partly because there's this whole almost cottage industry that has grown up around ghost detection. So, and it's really fleshed out, you know, with the EMs and all these different types of scientific sounding things. So it's been built up. They're all useless, but they do have this whole menagerie of things that they look for that are linked to ghosts. And this device is just catering to that.
Right.
Now to move on, George.
Yeah.
I read in the Conservapedia that E equals MC squared is pseudoscience.
Well, yeah. According to Conservapedia. Speaking of having your ideas be formed before any kind of evidence comes along, if you're not aware, Conservapedia is it's a Wikipedia, but it's created by Andrew Schlafly, who is the son of Phyllis Schlafly, who is a very famous conservative person. Conservapedia sort of puts a conservative spin on information. They were formed to counter the quote-unquote liberal bias of Wikipedia. So under this is not necessarily new news, but this was just made aware to me and it's fascinating. Under the article for relativity, they say that no theory has successfully united the laws governing mass with the laws governing light, and numerous attempts to derive E equals MC squared in general form, first principles, have failed. Political pressures, however, have made it impossible for anyone pursuing an academic career in science to even question the validity of this nonsensical equation. Simply put, E equals MC squared is liberal claptrap. So
yeah,
they go on to say that, you know, there's no proof for it. Only liberal second-tier college websites have that the equation is used in nuclear power generation and in nuclear weapons or nuclear fusion. Apparently, the editor or the creator, Mr. Schlafly, was asked about this. He sort of said, like, Do you have an article on your Conservapedia that says that E equals MC squared is some kind of liberal plot? How do you respond? And instead of, you know, giving the right answer of, oh, we should probably fix that, he said, no Nobel Prize has been given for this implausible formula, so no meaningful experimental verification of it has occurred. There is utterly no logical explanation for the formula. It's in the realm of science fiction at best and not as good as other types of science fiction. Now, the thing is that, yes, he's technically correct. Einstein didn't win a Nobel Prize for relativity. He won one for the photoelectric effect, and there's some debate as to why he didn't win one for relativity. Post-World War I anti-Semitism, all kinds of confusion about relativity, all entered into it. But to say that something isn't true because no one's won an award for it, that's a certain kind of fallacy. But it's amazing that this is there and that the conservative effort to be so consistently conservative could even carry over into something so generally accepted as relativity. And what's fascinating is, you know, in order to go on Conservapedia, you have to access the internet. And large chunks of the internet are, you know, broadcast using satellites. And satellites can only broadcast what they broadcast, you know, to your phone. If you're using your phone to go onto Conservapedia, you have to use a satellite. And that satellite is basically able to let itself know where you are because it's adjusted for all the relativistic effects that go into putting a satellite into orbit. Mm-hmm. So it's like you literally have to be able to accept that relativity is real in order to access the page that says that it's a liberal plot.
That's pretty funny.
It's amazing.
Jeez.
Wow. Here's an example of the level of argumentation that we get. So in the E equals MC squared Conservapedia article, it's talking about the claims of experimental verification, which are experimental verification of E equals MC squared. And it refers to a 2005 study by Simon Rainville et al. As published in Nature, and then in parentheses, which is not a leading physics journal. Yeah, Nature's not a leading physics journal. It's just one of the leading science journals in the world.
What the hell?
But it's not a leading physics journal.
That's...
Yeah.
Yeah, but what is Nature really?
It's a physics journal. It's not a leading...
It's not indignant.
It's not a leading relativity
journal. What's natural?
The motivated reasoning is astounding. The Conservapedia, you know, I've looked through some articles. It's shockingly childish.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it's hard to overstate it. It's amazing.
You hope that it's an onion offshoot. That's what it's like.
Yeah. It's so bad. Yeah, it's self-parody. It's at the point where you're thinking, God, somebody, there are liberals out there who are infiltrating Conservapedia to make conservatives look stupid. Because that's the only explanation for this level of dumbassitude.
Are they convincing anybody besides their really core base? I mean, who of a neutral position would go to that and say, oh, that's a reasonable position? I don't know. Nobody. It's absolute red meat for the base and nothing else. Why would you go there for anything like that?
It just goes right into the echo chamber, Ev. I mean, it has almost no impact.
Yeah, this is the echo chamber. That's exactly what it is. I read the entry on biblical scientific foreknowledge.
Yeah, I had that here too, which is nice, biblical scientific foreknowledge. You could abbreviate that BS, which is kind of nice.
BS. So BS foreknowledge is the fact that the Bible shows a comprehension of science far ahead of its time. Here's some examples. Uh-huh. Biblical scientific foreknowledge illustrates what is possible by educating us about the truth in the universe. However, Bible deniers, such as atheists and evolutionists, liberally deny the many truths in the Bible. Their irrational closed-mindedness against the Bible obstructs the advancement of science. For example, the book of Genesis gives an example of anesthesia, long before man discovered it in 1846. As another example, the fundamental chaos in the physical world was explained in the Bible long before quantum mechanics confirmed it in the 1900s.
Falling asleep in Bible class is not an example of anesthesia.
Yeah.
Well, anesthesia. Are you saying they use the word anesthesia in the Bible?
No, remember God put Adam to sleep and he took his rib to make Eve.
Oh, so this is
that
some
shows
sort of
foreknowledge of anesthesia.
Nostradamus quatrain sort of analysis of.
I love it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the fact they use the term closed-mindedness, you know, within that explanation, they're using the term closed-mindedness as a pejorative against the other side, saying that, you know, because you don't believe that the Bible talks about anesthesia, you're closed-minded. It's like,
reminds me, there are people living in their own reality. They're so far off the reservation, they really are living in their own world. All right, Jay, you're going to tell us about some good news on the regulating health claims front.
So we've discussed on the show how the quality of supplements have been studied and found to be very poor, right? Remember we talked about this, guys? There were some news items that came out. As an example, many supplements have been found to not contain the dose stated on the bottle. They're contaminated with what, like other substances from the factory, or in some cases, they flat out just didn't have any active ingredient that was on the label. So on February 2nd, 2015, the New York State Attorney General's office sent cease and desist letters to four major U.S. retailers who sell supplements. So we have Walmart, Walgreens, GNC, and Target. If you're not in the United States, these are four very large retailers. And they accused them of selling fraudulent and potentially dangerous herbal supplements and went as far as demanding that the named products be removed from the shelves. That is awesome. This is something that we've all been waiting for quite some time. The Food and Drug Administration, also known as the FDA, performed tests on the most popular top-selling store brands of herbal supplements, and they concluded that four out of five of the products tested did not contain any active ingredients. And when I say active ingredients, I simply mean what was on the label. And what they found was that the products with a label calling themselves medicinal herbs contained inexpensive fillers like powdered rice, amazingly inexpensive, asparagus, and houseplants. Hello. Some contain substances that are sometimes dangerous to those with specific allergies. And wait until you hear what they are, guys. All right, so to continue on, this is a big step forward because legal action is now being threatened against these big retail drugstores for selling products that are considered deliberately misleading the public.
Wow.
This shows deliberate deception on the part of the manufacturers and at the least negligence on the part of the retailers. Walgreens sells ginseng pills that only contain powdered garlic and rice. Walmart was selling ginkgo biloba pills that contain powdered radish, houseplants, and wheat. Now, what's more is that this specific product claimed to be wheat and gluten-free. Right? Target had its own list of mislabeled pills. Six products were tested. 50% were found to not contain any of the listed active ingredients like ginkgo biloba or St. John's wort, valerian root. But check this out. They found powdered rice, beans, peas, and wild carrots. Now, I put it to you, George.
Yes, sir.
Why not just sell that same pill as a vegetable supplement and call it a day? Right?
Perfect.
Rice, beans, peas, and wild carrots. I mean, that's actually – most people don't eat that.
This is the one time where like it being homeopathic would actually be better for you if you didn't have a gluten intolerance or something. Yeah. Wow.
And GNC was probably the worst because their products used legumes as fillers. Guys – many people are deadly allergic to peanuts and soybeans, and this is what they were putting in their pills as fillers. It's despicable. Oh, in the cease and desist letters, the retailers were asked to explain their quality assurance procedures that verify ingredients. I'm like laughing already. The response by the four companies varied. Here they are. Walgreens said it would remove the products from its shelves nationwide, even though only New York State has demanded it. Well, thanks, Walgreens. You've f***ed us for years. You're doing the right thing. Walmart said it would reach out to the suppliers of its supplements and quote unquote take appropriate action. Very mysterious, Walmart. Good job. You know, you earn billions of dollars a year off of us. And the best thing you could say is we're going to take appropriate action.
Uh-huh.
GNC said that the company would cooperate with the attorney general, quote, in all appropriate ways, end quote, but that it stood behind the quality and purity of its store brand supplements. The company said it tested all of its products, quote, using validated and widely used testing methods.
And it also said, how much do you bench?
Unfortunately, GNC, those validated and widely used testing methods missed legumes. Target did not respond to the request for comment.
Can you imagine any other kind of manufacturing company having doing that, like Ford Motor Company actually, there was no car in the car that I was sold. There was no car at all in the car that I was sold. It was actually a bicycle and a pumpkin. The box said car, so I assumed that I would have a car when I opened up the box. Like, no other, you know, I bought a suit. And, yeah, it turns out it wasn't a suit. It was a roll of duct tape and some nail polish.
Looks good on you.
Yeah, well, it's good this is getting the attention that it deserves, because the supplement industry is out of control. Bob, you know what hasn't happened in a while?
Yes, I do.
A quickie with Bob.
Hoo-hoo. Well, thank you, Steve. I've taken a lot of cold showers waiting for this moment. All right, guys, this is your quickie with Bob. You may remember one of the biggest science news stories in 2014. I got all excited over this. They declared essentially a twofold discovery. One, gravitational waves or ripples in space-time had been discovered and apparently caused by two, cosmic inflation, which was the brief but incredible expansion of our universe soon after the Big Bang. Amazing claims, fascinating as hell, but some scientists did not agree with their conclusion, claiming that they did not account for galactic dust, which messed up with their data. And they also, these other scientists also had data coming in from their Planck satellite to support their conclusion, which was a more of a solid blow against the original scientists. And now here comes another one. Most recently, they combined all of this data that had been combined, that had been collected, and they concluded again that the signal they were seeing is indeed due to galactic dust. So it's not looking good for this recent evidence for gravitational waves and support for cosmic inflation. So that's a bummer, but fear not, because they have not ruled out the possibility of discovering gravity waves or evidence for inflation. It's not something that can't exist now. There is a possibility that they may find subtle evidence that may be lurking in the data, or perhaps future experiments will identify it unequivocally. And I tend to think that it will come at some point. But what they claimed last year is not what they said it is, and they'll need to look deeper, look harder. Hopefully it won't take too long and cost too much money. But this has been your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Bob, what does Conservapedia say about
about gravity waves?
Oh my God! Yeah.
Isn't this a great example, though? Isn't this a perfect example that, like, okay, so these guys got excited. Here's a big discovery, and then a year later or half a year later, someone says, no, actually, you're not right. And do they double down and say, no, we're totally right. No, we're absolutely right. This is the, no, they don't do that. They look at the evidence and they say, oh crap, cosmic dust. Whoops. Okay. Our bad. We'll still try to look for it anyway. What a perfect example that people can use when people say, oh, scientists, you know, their minds are set. Their minds are set. You know, they never change their ways. They're closed minded. It's like perfect example. One of the potentially biggest discoveries in terms of cosmic stuff, and they have to go, oh,
it
shoot.
Was huge.
We didn't calculate for this. Okay, our bad. All right, let's keep working.
All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
All right, this week for Who's That Noisy, first we're going to discuss last week's noisy. So I asked our listeners to listen to the sound and then let me know if anything, you know, happened. Like, did they get a feeling off of it, a headache or some type of pressure or any kind of sensation? And I got several emails. I had one listener say that they were listening to the noise and they felt sort of disoriented or dizzy. And then I had another listener write in, or several write in and say yes, that there was some type of headache throbbing sensation. So let me play the sound for you again. Now, George, you let me know if you get any weird sensation off of this, okay?
All right, hit me.
Okay, so if you haven't heard that last week, or you know, experiencing it for the first time, did you feel anything? Did anything strange happen?
I have a desire for Cinnamon Toast Crunch.
That's very interesting, George. What's interesting is that this is what actually you were listening to.
Is that that was you? No way.
Yeah, that's me making fun of that really bad kung fu movie.
Kung
from
Pao
the,
Chicken?
The,
Kung Pao Chicken.
It was the early 90s?
Oh, yeah.
Kung Pao or whatever, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is an experiment in something called a nocebo. A nocebo is, you could say, called an inert substance or whatever, something inert that has or seems to create harmful effects. The reason why anybody experienced anything negative was because I suggested subtly that something negative was going to be the effect. I was trying to sound actually vague, but I did implant a few ideas in there. And the fact of the matter is that people wrote in and confirmed that they did get some type of sensation or feeling off of this. Now, of course, the vast majority of you had no experience whatsoever. You just were hearing a sound and you know, maybe paying very close attention to it. But there was no discernible effect. But a small portion of people will have a reaction to things like this.
It's like whenever they talked about lice in school, everybody started itching their heads.
Yeah. So those kind of sensations are just, they're highly suggestible.
So this week's Who's That Noisy? Take a listen.
That was cool.
Yeah, whatever it is, it landed.
It sounded like a retro science fiction sound effect.
Yeah.
Wait until next week. You are not going to believe what that noisy is.
Oh, cool, Jay.
Okay. Wow. All right, guys. We have another dumbest thing I heard this week.
Oh, awesome.
All right.
We're still thinking about the title. I'm going to use that as my working title. The dumbest thing I heard this week.
Endless amount of candidates. So,
always a lot of contenders, you know, when you start paying attention. But I think, hands down, in my opinion, the guy who takes the cake this week is Dr. Jack Wolfson.
Oh, yes. Oh, my.
Also known as the paleocardiologist.
Paleo diet kind of
thing. Arizona guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, man. This guy's a piece of work. So he wrote this rant. I don't know of any other way to describe it. Essentially reacting to the backlash against anti-vaxxers because of the measles outbreak in Disneyland, right? So he writes this completely ranting criticism of people who are criticizing anti-vaxxers. And it's like, oh, why are you people so angry? This is what you should be angry at. And then he goes on this long diatribe. Like, one example is, be angry with pharmaceutical companies for allowing us to believe living the above life can be treated with drugs. Correctly prescribing drugs kills thousands of people per year. The flu kills just about no one. The vaccine never works. So yeah, his points are all equally factually challenged. You know, he's just making sure, basically.
Yeah.
The flu kills thousands of people a year. Thank you. Not no one. Unfortunately, this earned him around on the media. You know what I mean? People were interviewing him as the other side of the false balance equation. But a few more gems came out of that. He was asked specifically if, you know, he feels any responsibility for protecting other children. And he said, I'm not going to sacrifice the well-being of my child. My child is pure. It's not my responsibility to be protecting their children. He's talking about getting his children vaccinated. His child is pure, Jay.
P-O-E.
Yeah, that's a good quote. Yeah, pure.
He has purity of essence. P-O-E.
That's right.
Now, he's saying that because his child has not received any medication whatsoever in his entire life?
No toxins, nothing impure, Jay.
He has not received any toxins whatsoever. He is pure. My pure child. Yes.
They said, okay, what about, so there are some children who have like leukemia and will get sick, and there's one child with leukemia who came down with measles. Would you feel bad if like a child with leukemia died because they got measles from an unvaccinated child? And he said, I could live with myself easily. It's an unfortunate thing that people die, but people die. And I'm not going to put my child at risk to save another child. So the guy is completely unrepentant. And then he said about the girl with leukemia, as far as I'm concerned, it's very likely that her leukemia is from vaccinations in the first place.
There's something wrong with this guy.
That's the icing on the cake right there.
Yeah.
This was so over the top. I thought this was a work. I started just trying to find out if this guy was like a joke because it was so over the top. Yeah. And then I found his practice and I found like his site and then like, you know, found stuff in Arizona and patients of his. And I thought, wow, this is like the best work ever. And it turns out, no, this guy is legitimately
for reals. Yeah.
For real. It's unbelievable.
And if you want to lose utter faith in humanity, man, read the comments to his blog post.
Yeah.
His rant.
Yeah. I made that mistake.
Can I indulge for 1 second? Can I ask just one thing?
Go ahead.
Jay and Bob and Evan came down to see the funk band a couple weeks ago, which was really fun. Dynamite. I'm really glad you guys came. It was really awesome.
It was fantastic. Had such a great time. You guys rocked.
Thank you. It was really fun, and it was great to see you guys in the audience and the families and everybody.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
You guys remember Alyssa, who was our – it was our singer.
Yes.
Fantastic. Just incredible. Well, something I couldn't share with you at the time, but I want her to share now because she's made it sort of official. She's actually in stage 4 stomach cancer.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, when you saw her perform, she was diagnosed with that. She started her chemo treatments today. Today's Tuesday, and she started her chemo treatments. And I just wondered, because you guys have such a massive audience, if there is anyone out there who wants to send her good vibe in the form of an email, you can send it to me, geo@geologicrecords.net. Her name is Alyssa. She's an amazing person. She has a very long fight ahead of her now. If you want to send me an email, especially from all over the world, it would be really, really cool just to let her know that people all over the planet and SGU listeners are just – that somewhere in one little portion of everyone's brain she's being thought about just for a second. Send me an email, geo@geologicrecords.net, and just say, get well, Alyssa. We're thinking about you. That would be really, really cool.
And, Gio, how is Alyssa spelled?
A-L-I-S-A.
Okay.
It's like Alyssa, yeah, but it's Alyssa. So A-L-I-S-A. Just, if you have 2 seconds, send me a thing. I know most people out there, don't know who she is, but those that have seen her perform know she's just an amazing person. Her attitude is incredible, and I just wanted to take advantage of your listeners' generosity and your guys' generosity as well. So our thoughts are, we're thinking about her.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, we are.
Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You guys ready for this week? We got 3 regular news items for you, no theme. Bob, you think you're going to keep up your perfect record?
No.
No?
He's not talking. He doesn't want to go first. He doesn't want to say a word.
Wow. All right, here we go.
I know you.
Item number 1. Scientists have discovered an organism that has not evolved detectably in over 2 billion years. All right, number 2. Step aside graphene. Scientists have created a working transistor out of silicene, a 1-atom thick sheet of silicone. And item number 3, a 10-year multi-hospital study finds that tracking and reporting surgical outcomes resulted in a 30% decrease in overall surgical complications. Evan, go first.
Scientists have discovered an organism that has not evolved detectably in over 2 billion years. How many things are still floating or rolling around the planet that are 2 billion years and... maybe it's an extremophile or something. I mean, maybe it'd be something that, you know, is living at the super duper depths of pits of Hades of the earth. And, all right. Maybe, second one, scientists have created a working transistor out of, silicene, 1-atom thick sheet of silicon. I think of the 3, I think this one's giving me the least amount of fits. Yeah, that's awesome. 1-atom thick is not thick at all, obviously. The last one, 10-year multi-hospital study. Tracking and reporting surgical outcomes resulted in a 30% decrease in overall surgical complications. Well, I mean, that sounds kind of right on the surface, but I think there's something else going on here. I'll say the multi-hospital study one's the fiction because I just can't really put my finger on exactly why, whereas the other one's... Yeah, I have a little more confidence in.
Okay, Bob.
So we've got an organism that hasn't evolved in 2 billion years. That's a hell of a long time. it's not so much commentary on the organism. It's a commentary on the environment the organism was in. So yeah, is it possible that there are environments that can support life that have been stable and unchanging for 2 billion years? Well, probably sure. But still, 2 billion, that's amazing. Let's see, psilocene. Yeah, man, I've heard of psilocene. Oh man, I don't know. I don't know enough about psilocene to really critique that. That kind of stinks. And then we got the hospital study number 3, 30% decrease just because they were tracking and reporting surgical outcomes. Yeah, I could obviously see an issue or a decrease in complications because you're tracking, you're specifically tracking and reporting on the surgical outcomes. So people will be extra careful, but 30%, is big. It's really big. All right. I think 30% is just a little bit too high. I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, my gut reaction was that the 2 billion year old organism not evolving seemed like crazy. And then I'm just thinking this has got to be some kind of bacteria or whatever. And I know the least about this hospital thing. And I agree with Bob. 30% seems like too much. That's a fiction.
And George.
Boy, the 2 billion thing. Yes. Seems crazy, but aren't there tardigrades or tardigrades, whatever they're called, that are billions of years old? So I'm going to say that's real. The psilocene, one atom thick. I think that's the fiction. I think when you're getting into one atom thicknesses, I think you're starting to mess with quantum stuff. So that's kind of weird to me, but it seems like it's plausible. So that to me is the fiction. And the 30% hospital thing, that makes sense. And if it's like actually 32%, then I will be very angry at you, Steve. But, I know you wouldn't do that. I know you wouldn't do that because that's not the kind of guy you are. You're a humble kind of, guy. So I'm going to say the psilocene, because just to say psilocene is fun. That's the fiction.
So you all agree on number one, scientists have discovered an organism that has not evolved detectably in over 2 billion years. You all think that one is science.
That's right.
And that one is science.
Oh,
yay. All right.
Extremophile.
Very cool. Well, it's a Bob. You read this?
Wow.
One,
huh?
Yeah, this one I did read, and it made sense.
I could always
it made
tell.
Made sense to me. Yeah.
Let's play poker sometime, Bob.
No, you can't always tell. Believe me.
So that's true. It's a toupee fallacy.
So what is it?
It's a bacteria. it's a sulfur eating bacteria. And yeah, Bob is right that it's the environment that has been stable for so long. So they have fossilized colonies of this bacteria from 2.3 billion years ago, and they look the same as the fossils from 1.8 billion years ago, which look the same as the living bacteria from today off the coast of Chile. Indistinguishable from modern sulfur bacteria found in mud off the coast of Chile. So obviously we don't have the genetics, you know, from the 2 billion year old bacteria, but that's why I said detectably. It has not evolved detectably. It looks to be exactly the same. So it's a long time, but if the environment is stable, it's at equilibrium with the environment, there really isn't any evolutionary pressure. Yeah, it might drift around a little bit, but there could be no appreciable, accumulating evolutionary change. In fact, there may be selective pressures against any changes. If it's really tightly adapted to its environment, the evolutionary pressures might keep it from changing as long as that environment is stable.
Yep, exactly.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah.
Still pretty amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, the 2 billion like really catches your attention. Yeah.
It's a huge, it's even bigger than 500.
Yeah, it's bigger than 500. And by the way, George, tardigrades have been around for about 530 million years, not billions.
Still a big number.
All right.
No, big number. That's a long time for a multicellular animal. It is.
Yes. And if they were podcasting, then they could.
But George, Steve can admit when he's wrong, so don't worry.
It's true. I'm just trying to keep people from yelling
us. Wrong.
Is it tardigrade or tardigard?
Tardigrade.
That was Marty.
Tardigrade. Okay.
Just call them a bug bear, George.
Yeah. They're water bears or my favorite, moss piglets.
And they're adorable.
Yeah.
Ish.
Ish.
Okay. Half billion years. Sorry.
Hey, it's the SGUA, George. Otherwise, we get emails.
I got you. You're right.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Let's go on to number 2. Step aside. Graphene scientists have created a working transistor out of silicene, a one atom thick sheet of silicon. George, you think this one is the fiction. The regular rogues all think this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, yeah, George.
Yeah. The nano revolution continues. Yeah.
Sorry, I lost it.
That's it. That's why I am where I am. I am only at 400 and you are at 500. And this is the evidence. That's it. Maybe in 100 more.
This is a tough one. This one, you know,
a working transistor.
I mean, that's new. That's quite the breakthrough. However, Bob, did you read this one?
You know, I read this like a goddamn week ago. So where are you pulling this for a week? I thought this was supposed to be current, and I remembered almost nothing about what I read. So I was squirming in my seat because there's nothing worse than actually reading it and then not effing remembering what you read.
Right.
Tell me about it.
So the downside of the transistor is that it survived for only a couple of minutes before the silicene evaporates away. So yeah, so carbon is really the only monolayer that we've made that is stable enough that you can keep it like in the open air and it will persist because, you know, the carbon bonds are really strong and the graphene, you know, the structure is really, really strong. And you can just, you know, you could sticky tape them off of graphite. You know that? You could just pull a single layer of graphene off of graphite. It's a lot harder to do the other monolayers like of silicon. Silicon, you know, is right below carbon on the periodic table. So it's kind of very similar, but it doesn't have the flexibility that carbon has in terms of the bonds that it can make. But in any case, the silicene, it's harder to make and if it's exposed to the air, it will only last for a very short period of time. But what the researchers did was they formed the silicene sheet on a thin layer of silver. Then they added a 5-nanometer thick layer of alumina on top. Then they peeled the silicene sandwich off of its mica base, flipped its silver side up, and laid it on an oxidized silicon substrate. Got that?
All right. Oh, yeah, well,
so that worked. Yeah. Okay. It was a very clever trick, obviously, they said, and it allowed it. Yeah, so you have this sandwich, basically, it sort of, which protected it long enough for them to make a transistor out of it. Now, there may be other ways to get, you know, longevity out of this. You know, you could make the layers a little bit thicker. You can coat it with something, et cetera. So it's still, you know, some people are still skeptical about whether or not silicene is going to pan out as a technologically useful material because there are still some hurdles that we need to get over. But it has some very interesting properties. It's actually superior to graphene in that graphene may not really be useful in terms of making logic circuits because it is so uniform. But silicene, it's like kinked, you know, so it's like a wave. The different layers, if you imagine you know what I mean? Like that single layer, it's not flat. It sort of goes up and down and up and down and up and down. So that allows for there to be differences in the states of the electrons. And therefore you could use it kind of as an one and zero system. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So it's actually a better material for making transistors than graphene in that respect. But graphene is more stable and easier to make than silicene. But in any case, the transistor is a proof of concept. Who knows? Maybe in 5 to 10 years we'll have silicene transistors.
We'll find out between episodes 750 and 1000.
All of this means that a 10-year multi-hospital study finds that tracking and reporting surgical outcomes resulted in a 30% decrease in overall surgical complications is the fiction.
Is it higher, actually?
What do you think the number is, George? You think it might be higher?
I think it's higher.
What do you guys think? You guys thought
just because I want to be wrong as much as I possibly can, so I'm going to say higher.
8%.
5%.
2.
0. There was no difference.
Zero.
Yeah, they basically said, so unfortunately, it's not so easy to reduce the complication rate just by tracking, you know, and reporting on them. Not a bad idea. But the other thing is, so this was a 263 hospital study over 10 years, analyzing 1,226,000 seniors enrolled in Medicare who had one of 11 major operations.
You fix nothing.
So, over the 10 years,
you lose.
The complication rate went down in every hospital to the same degree. So there was no advantage for the hospitals that were participating in this surgical quality improvement program that was tracking outcomes and reporting them. So the idea was if we give this information back to the hospitals would use that information to improve their performance, but it just didn't have any measurable effect or cost savings. So it's a nice idea, just a failed experiment. Well, guys, good job. George made a very valiant effort.
Yeah, thank you. That's
like Prince, nice like Prince.
Have I ever gotten one right? I don't think I've ever gotten one right. And yeah, that's why you have to. We need another 500 shows. I'm telling you. Maybe amongst those 500, I'll get one right.
We will keep bringing you back until you get a science or fiction right, okay, George?
Oh, okay.
But see, then I just created a perverse incentive for you to throw science or fiction every time, so we keep bringing you back.
Maybe I've been doing that all along. Clever. So clever.
All right, Evan, give us the skeptical quote of the week.
Here it is, folks. If you are searching for sacred knowledge and not just a palliative for your fears, then you will train yourself to be a good skeptic. The wife of Carl Sagan, Andruyan, she said that as part of a introduction in a book called The Varieties of Scientific Experience. And she was in part describing her husband Carl's personal view in the search for God, and that's how she wrapped up that portion of it. Prior to having met Carl Sagan, Anne believed in the ancient astronauts of Erich von Däniken, Chariots of the Gods, and all that good stuff, which I did not know.
Not surprising.
That's very surprising.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not that surprising. I mean, we fell for all that crap when we were younger. George, did you believe in any of that stuff when you were younger?
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally wanted to. Actually, I had books on ghosts. I had books on ancient astronauts. And then like a light switch one day, because it just did, some of it made sense and some of it didn't. And the parts that didn't just kept confusing me. And then like a switch, it occurred to me, oh, none of it's real.
Yeah, none of it's real. Yeah.
That makes so much more sense. The fact that none of it is like, how could this ghost be here? Like that. Oh, wait a minute. None of it's real. No ESP and no ghosts and no ancient astronauts. That makes way more sense. And it was like, it was just uncovering my eyes. It was awesome.
Yeah, all you have to do is accept the fact that people are largely full of it, which is not hard to accept.
Yeah, you understand that. So.
So, George, you're going to be hosting our Skeptical Extravaganza on Friday night before Nexus.
This is true. I'm excited. We get to do it on not American soil because it's at one time, but on this coast in front of a whole new audience.
Our first East Coast performance. That's
yes.
Correct.
In New York City, of all places.
Yeah. It's going
to
be great.
So, George, what is the extravaganza?
The extravaganza manages to coalesce the vapors of all of existence into a two-hour experience involving questions and some pants. No, I mean, it's
there are pants. There will be pants on stage.
There are pants that are involved. No, it's the extravaganza. This is this wonderful thing we put together for our tour of Australia and New Zealand. It's a combination, quiz show and debate contest and sketch show and music extravaganza and question and answer session and variety program. It's all of those things with some of your favorite rogues, or actually all of your favorite rogues and me. It's a totally different yet similar yet unknowing yet knowledgeable kind of thing that you can experience at Nexus. No, it's the rogues and me, rogues and I will be on stage.
Yes.
Performing in a way that you maybe have never seen them perform before, but it's the familiar people that you know from the show. And it worked so well when we did this thing in California, as well as Australia and New Zealand. And the response was really positive. And I think I speak for everybody when I say we're all excited to do it again.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. I absolutely love doing
it. It's a great time. Fun.
So go to nexus.org, NECSS.org, to register for the conference and to register separately for the extravaganza. Again, there you can go to that just by itself as a standalone event. There are plenty of workshops, new speakers being announced, so check it out. When the final speaker list is all set, we'll go through it again, give you all those names. We go to the site right now to check it out. All right, George, well, thanks for joining us for our 500th episode. It's been a lot of fun.
Congratulations, guys. On behalf of all the non-rogues on the planet, which is mostly everybody, congratulations for being the gold standard for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Really awesome. It's really, and thanks for including me, as always.
I appreciate it.
We love you, George.
Likewise.
All right. Well, everyone, until next week and the first of our next 500 episodes, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.